This general discussion took place on 10/23/2021 on the seventh weekday on the Irish State of Econtis site.
This is interesting. The other day, what was I going to say? This is it. Brother Will will tell you this story about St. Patrick, what happened to him the other day. Go ahead, Will.
Okay. Well, I was Dermot. You guys know that Dermot put that clip on about the death of St. Patrick, right, on there. I think it was on the general, right? It was like the closing. It was an audio book, and he put the last part as part seven, I think they called it. Well, I had come home. It was the 19th, I think it was. I forget what day it was. But, I mean, I came home from doing my chores or whatever, and I was listening to that, and it was really good. The you know, how he was when he was dying and where he died and all this. And I said, wow, this is interesting. And it was inspiring me to want to go study more about his life. So I said, I mean, like I have, but I haven't really in-depthly studied him. You know what I mean? So, like, I've skimmed over his confessions, but now I really read them. But anyway, so I was like, after that, it was like 4 o'clock my time. And I'm like, well, I'm definitely doing this after I do my prayers. I'm getting my comp line done early and I'm going to go study, you know, St. Patrick tonight. So I ate dinner, come back, did my comp. I did all my prayers. I'm ready to go. And I said, you know, I says, I got a little room in the place where I'm at. And I want to get a clock, a digital clock, so I can know the time. And it's kind of like a weight room thing, exercise. So I want to know the time and temperature and stuff, because we're doing wine in there too. So I was on the internet, Amazon. I said, well, let me go look at this first. So I ordered this clock, right? So on Amazon, they have like, sometimes they have like a 2 minute or 3 minute video showing, you know, the what the product is. So I go to this clock, it's a digital clock. And I'm clicking on the video. It's a 3 minute video. And the guy's showing me, okay, how do you set the clock according, you know, to the clock and stuff like that. So he says the time first, and then he goes, the date. Let's pick a date. He goes, how about 3/17 St. Patrick's Day? I said, oh, thank you. Thank you, Lord. I mean, that's what I knew. I'm like, I gotta be watching St. Patrick. I mean, he was like showing me, you know, yeah, read my confessions and learn about St. Patrick. And then I had a thing where I check the scores of you know, different sporting matches, but I was just checking the score, right? And I had on my desktop on my computer, ESPN. It's a big famous sports station here in the U.S. Ryan Shinuda would know what I'm talking about. But I have it on my lower right hand corner, right? So I was gonna go right after I did the clock thing. I was gonna go check a score real quick and then go to, and I went on my main display and the icon for ESPN was gone. And it's always there, you know? I said, wait a minute, all right. I'm not even going to look, Lord. I'm going right to the confessions right now, you know what I mean? So, because, like, the next day when I was on the computer, the ESPN thing was back on there again. So I knew he wanted it. He took it off, so I would go right to St. Patrick. So it was excellent. So I read his confessions, and then I started looking at that video from the beginning. And then the guy that's on there, Father Bullen Morris. Well, I never knew his last name was Morris until I thought his Father William Bullen. So I'm like looking at the other, I'm like, wait a minute, his last name's Morris. It's like,
his name's William.
William Morris. I'm like, this is like crazy. It's like one letter off from my name. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my goodness. But definitely St. Patrick is a hot topic right now. So yeah.
I was telling Will, it's like St. Patrick was looking right over his shoulder.
I know, it was.
It's good.
Yeah, it's like, ever since I watched that movie, I can't get St. Patrick out of my head. I'm telling everybody about him.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
You know, watch that movie.
It is beautiful. That movie was so powerful when I watched it. I thank God for it, because I always knew that's the way it had to be.
Yeah.
Because think about it. 4 people go to Ireland, and it's totally pagan and barbaric. And how can they convert Ireland with the power of God? And that movie shows it so perfectly. And as a matter of fact, what I want to do is, that guy, Bishop Healy had, probably was an apostate, but he wrote a good book on Patrick at least. And I pulled out all the areas that correlate to the movie, because it's accurate. That movie's, not only is that movie accurate as to what Patrick did with his miracles, Patrick did even more than what the movie shows. I mean, that's why I call him the Moses of Ireland.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Matter of fact, I'm going to PDF this thing right now and send it to you. I'm going to hook it up, and you'll see it's the areas I pulled out in which the movie showed those miracles that took place in the movie, and it just verifies it. But it was so beautiful, that movie, and it was full of power, you know, and the power of God. Mm-hmm. No wimpiness.
No.
You know, you don't mess around with God, you know, or you're going to get in trouble. And how he protected Patrick. Okay, so Dermot's online now also. By the way, Philip, can you still hear us, Phil?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we could. There's a 100% Irishman, Philip McCabe, from Alabama. From the
I'm on the text general page.
Yeah, that's right. But you're also on the That's okay.
Really good to hear your voice, Phil, and really happy that your mic is working finally.
Yeah.
He's very zealous, Philip McCabe. He'll tell you a story one day, but he was with the CMRI group with Stuttgart. Anyway, that's a whole
story. Help me admonishing that CMRI guy in Ireland.
Yeah, that's who Phil was once a brother in that group up in, where was it, Phil, in Washington? Were you?
Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and later in Spokane, Washington.
Yeah.
Hey, so Dermot, thanks for posting that thing on St. Patrick for inspiring me.
Hey, I'm glad you got inspired out of it because I was inspired too. I'm reading all about him. Anything I can find on him.
Yeah, his confessions. Well, I put the confessions up, so they got that.
Oh, did you? That book on Healy, I can post that up too.
I'm going to
do that right now for you. Now, Patrick did some power. You know, it's more than what you even saw in the movie. But that movie was so well done, and it was so beautiful. You know, and let me see. And the guy who played Patrick, what was his name, the actor?
Oh, yeah, Bergen.
He's a good actor, yeah.
Patrick Bergen,
yeah.
Yeah, Bergen.
It was the Healy one. I'm going to post up the book right now. And he was friends with Martin of Tours. I call Martin of Tours the Moses of France, like the area in France. He was so powerful. You're talking about France. It was also another bulwark of the church. And you had like Clovis was the first pagan king that converted, and from there came Charlemagne.
Right. That book that you have, Life of St. Martin of Tours, by Severus Simple or something
that. Yeah.
That book is really good.
Yeah. Sulpicius Severus. Yeah. Really good. I call him like the Moses of France. Really powerful. And they knew one another. It's very interesting. Huh?
He did miracles. Brother Richard, didn't St. Martin of Tours do miracles even as a catechumen?
I don't know if he did miracles as a catechumen. We thought that, right? But when I reread it, I don't think I read that he did miracles as a catechumen. I'm not saying he didn't do it, but I don't think it clearly says that. So I have to double check on that. I'm not saying it can't happen, but I think I did check it and I didn't find no proof of that, but it doesn't mean it can't happen. When you look at that movie, if that doesn't inspire you, you know, only people who don't have faith would put down a movie like that. And I used to say to people, like, you're looking at Harry Potter and all this other stuff and you believe in that. How come you don't want to believe when you have a good Catholic movie with, you know, from the Catholic perspective, you know? Catholics with the power of God. It's smiting the devils. I love, you know, I love the, Benignus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love Benignus.
Yeah.
I love Benignus. Yeah, St. Benignus. I love that one scene where he says, I think there's nothing I like better when I see people open their hearts to God. Now, other than saving your own soul, there's nothing better than other people coming to God. The only thing you got to watch out for is don't put carts before horses. Because, sure, I do want that, but, you know, I'm not going to be making somebody better than they are or something that unless they approve themselves, you know, which is another issue. Now, let's see, what else do we have here? Somebody was talking about, I just noticed when I clicked on here, somebody's saying there's a new film about false signs and wonders out there.
I believe that was Shannon.
Yeah.
She's dropped off the chat there, so I don't know where she is.
Okay.
I looked it up. It looked like more of a horror movie.
I know what you're saying, If it's too much of a horror...
I'm sure it had false signs in it, though.
Yeah, I know. That's the other thing. If it's too much of a horror movie, too much, then it's irredeemable. But if like the case 39 was borderline, but that was good enough. That was still good to put up there because there's a big lesson in that movie, case 39. Tremendous lesson about trusting little kids because they look so innocent and so nice. It'll help you overcome your idolization of children. And if there's a lot of stuff in there that was worthy keeping. So some of them you can keep. It all depends on how far they go with it. And if it's just over the hill or if it's redeemable. So I'll have to look at what she's talking about on that.
I reckon which we could run through one of them lessons.
Yes, good. Okay. Anybody, any questions on the lessons?
I know, what's it called? Declan posted 3 questions there already.
Oh, did he? There's questions here. Oh, let me look at this. Declan did. Yeah, he's not on here now. Let me see. What was he asking, Declan? Is in the general section?
General section, 12 of it, today, 1723.
Okay. Hi, we'll be working tonight. I have some questions for a catechism. Was, should a person be denounced a heretic, even non-Catholics? Best way to follow commandments to keep out of sin. Best way to keep it, follow commandments is the 3 pillars. Prayer, penance, and studying the Catholic faith. That's it. That's all God asks. You know, when you're looking at a lot of these biblical movies, beautiful, wonderful movies, King David, every one of them, what the prophets tell when he ordaining David, or he was consecrating David, he says, obey God, keep his commandments, and your enemies will flee from you, and you will prosper. And to keep the commandments, you got to do your prayers, you're studying the Catholic faith, and your penance. You do those 3 things, that's how you keep the commandments. It's not just an intellectual thing, or even just something you say, I desire to do, unless you're doing the 3 pillars. Because if you're not doing the 3 pillars, you're not being obedient to God. You're not having devotion to God to gain yourself the grace to keep the commandments. That's why I say anybody that falls out, they're neglecting one of those 3 pillars. Prayer, penance, or studying the Catholic faith, which includes reading the Bible. If you read your Bible at least 3 times a week, or we do it every day, you'll find out God talks to you in that Bible every day. He speaks to you. He's talking to you. He's admonishing you. He's rewarding you. He's confirming you. He's edifying you. So these are the way you keep the commandments. He also said, how do you know if you're in a state of sin? You can know if you're in a state of sin easier than you can know if you're in a state of grace. They say you can't really know if you're in a state of grace unless it's by a special revelation from God, and you got to still hope it is God and not the devil fooling you. You can have a moral certainty that you're in a state of grace, a moral certainty, because God be confirming you, there's things going right, and God's confirming certain things, and that's fine. And so you can have a moral certainty, but I think God always keeps it a little bit on the, so you always got to examine your conscience, but you don't want to be scrupulous neither. Scrupulous people can have problems with that. But it's not too hard to know some of the more grievous sins. But some of the more finer sins, like calumnies, detractions, when can you talk about someone? When can you not talk about someone? Are you loving the brother, a brother the way you should? Are you helping him the way you should? And sometimes those are just false and venial sins. But you want to also, try to conquer them too. Because if you're an obstinate venial sins, then it could lead to mortal sins. Now, I think you also said something here, Declan, about unknown past sins. If you've forgotten, like all of us, right? I mean, I came in when I was around 40 years old, and even then I wasn't in right away. So you're not going to remember all your past sins. That's obvious. So when you, if we had a priest and you were to confess to a Catholic priest, and you would say, and forgive me for these my sins and all the sins which I cannot now remember, and they're remitted. God will remit them. He knows you're not holding it back, a sin that you know about. It's something you forgot, and God will remit it for you. That's how your unknown past sins get remitted. He was asking that. Now,
as long as someone does a true examination of conscience to their best ability, that's all you can do, really.
That's right. Yeah, and you will. You get a good one, and it will. You'll say, "Wow, I did this. Oh, okay, I did that." And because a lot of times you don't get that anymore. There's no such thing as mortal sins anyway anymore, or even sins. So you get a good examination of conscience, and then after that, you're not going to remember every little sin you committed, and God will remit it. And then from that point, go forward. And that's why we even say at the end on our rule, we have this in the rule, at the end of every day, when just before compline, just think about what you did during the day and contemplate. Was there anything maybe you did wrong? Or sometimes it's you didn't do anything, but it's something that you should have done that you didn't do. You weren't as diligent as you should have been. You didn't finish something you should have finished. And, you don't want scruples to get you in either, because recreation is part of what you should do too. I go as far as to say, if you're supposed to recreate and you don't, you're sinning, because you're trying to be Superman. You're trying to, you're not recreating, which is part of the rule also. Or you're praying too much. You can pray too much, and you can study too much, or you can study too little. And so it's a proper balance, and that's why the rule, when you have the rule, we have the proper, sometimes God will inspire you too at certain times to pick up and read like St. Patrick or lives of the, other lives of the saints or whatever. But as long as you're doing the three pillars, you're going to be fine with God. He'll recoup you, and if you're doing something wrong, he'll correct you very quickly. Within same day, maybe the next day, he'll bring it to your mind. He'll correct you quickly if you're doing the three pillars. But if you're not doing the three pillars, prayer, apprentice, Sunday, Catholic faith, you're gonna eventually fall away. He said something here about, I don't know what he means by that. Should a person be denounced a heretic, even non-Catholics? I'm not sure what he means about that. But your obligation to profess.
I guess because a heretic is technically a baptized person. I think he's saying, so just like random people on the street, would you call them a heretic?
No, or? I know what you mean. Yeah, like a Protestant. No, they're heretics, but you don't have to denounce everybody. And you don't have to condemn, or should be condemning people forever. It's crazy. As I said, you're not going to profess the faith unless you're obliged to, when people come up to you directly and they're speaking to you and they're saying something to you that requires a Catholic response, and only then. So you know you're not required to denounce every heretic, because you wouldn't even get this. You wouldn't be able to sleep. You'd have to go out in your neighborhood and all your neighbors and everybody you pass. When you go to the supermarket, you'd have to admonish everybody in the supermarket and all the people that are at the... It's crazy. So no. But the only the people that you really are more concerned about are your own brothers. And you don't club them over the head for venial sins and faults. Those are things where St. Paul said, bear with your brother's weaknesses and burdens, and don't club them over the head for their faults and venial sins. But if they're in mortal sin, if it's a brother, then you definitely got to say something to a brother if he's in mortal sin, of course. And then you got to avoid him too. You can't even eat with him. St. Paul says that in 1 Corinthians 5:11. Go ahead.
One question that was always kind of on my mind is the idea of venial mortal sins. And what I did gather was it's implied very clearly in the Bible that there are some that are, you know, serious, but then there's others that are more serious mortal sins. So my question would be, when did the church start talking between mortal sins and venial sins, and was there ever a list of these sins?
Yeah, there was a list. They did talk about it, but I like to study myself, the church fathers. With the big mortal sins they always spoke about, the three biggies was murder, adultery, and what was the other one? Apostasy. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Ryan got it. Murder, adultery, and apostasy. They always mentioned those as the three biggies. And adultery came under the idea of fornication. And they would have really severe penalties for those. That goes back to the early days of the church, right from the beginning. And so you can infer that there were lesser sins with lesser penalties. So therefore, you have venial sins, and you also have mortal sins, that some which are worse than others. So stealing's even a mortal sin, but it's not as bad as adultery, but they're both mortal sins. It's in the Bible even, where it talks about stealing's not as bad as murder, but both inherit hell. It's in one of the Bible lying verses. Lying and stealing, the liar's worse than the stealer, right, or something. So the Bible talks about mortal sins that are different. Some are worse than others. So that, I think you can probably trace that right back to the birth of the church. And it's a natural, it's a common sense thing too. If you had kids in the house, you know, and one kid, he eats between meals, and you told him don't eat between a meal. And another kid, he's out there beating up his sister, or he's doing something worse, you know. So that's a natural law kind of thing, that there's certain sins that are worse than others.
Yeah, I suppose people generally would love to have a list. These are the mortal sins, these are the venial sins, and as you said, there's also errors. I don't know the difference.
Faults, I know what you mean. It gets kind of, a fault might be something where you should have spent another 15 minutes finishing your book, but instead you didn't do it. You know, that might be a fault, which could lead to a venial sin. But usually, if I'm not sure if I committed a venial sin or a mortal sin, I always presume it's a mortal sin. I presume the mortal sin. And I go, Lord, if it's not a mortal sin, fine, but I presume it's a mortal sin because I'm not sure. Sometimes you could be sure that it's only a venial sin or a fault. And because now this, I know what you're saying, Thomas, because scrupulous people can go to town. Every little fault, every little venial sin, they think is a mortal sin, and they torture themselves. Because it's even in scripture, it says, a just man shall fall seven times and rise again. but the evil man shall fall down into wickedness. So even the just men commit venial sins and faults, but they confess them and they come right out of them real quick. And even they can commit mortal sins like King David did, murder and adultery, and he came out of it and confessed. So it is good to have some type of I think on mortal sins, though, some of the real gross ones are obvious. Like if you're a believer and you fornicated, I mean that's obvious. I mean, you can't hide that one. You fornicated. You've done something sexual that's not correct. If you, I don't know, like murdered somebody on and you didn't kill them, like it's unjust, you know, like. But see, sometimes you can justifiably kill somebody, so that's another issue. It all depends on the motive and the reason. But there are borderline things, and when I get with myself, what I do is if it's borderline, I say, I presume it's a mortal sin, and I confess it. And then, you know, and so I would presume the mortal sin if it's a borderline thing.
Yeah, it's prudent. And as I said, don't be scrupulous. It's just for these serious things that you're not sure about, basically.
Yeah, right. A scrupulous person, and I dealt with a few of them, they have no peace. And it's scrupulous is sort of like seated in pride. It's seated in it's really bad because they like stoicism, and they torture themselves. Absolutely torture themselves. And a good confessor's got to know what kind of person he's dealing with when they go to confession. Because some things, too, you think, I ask God, too, like to give me signs if I committed a sin. And God works with each person in his own way. And you could even, when you pray to God, it's a good thing. Say, Lord, is this a sin I committed or not? If it is a sin, let me know in some way. Let me know if it's a sin in some way or another, and don't let me go on thinking it's not a sin. So these are all prayers that are pleasing to God. And if you're doing your three pillars, God will make it available to you. He'll bring it up to your attention. And usually if you're doing what we say and you're examining your conscience every night before complying, just 5 minutes. That don't take long. 3 minutes, 5 minutes. What did I do today? I mean, then you're keeping up on it, you know? And the only time people would need a list anyway, or maybe for if you want to do all your past sins and you got to, because you haven't confessed for such a long time. And that's when you had Catholic priests to confess to. But we don't. We confess to God, and he's remitting our sins. Once you're in the church and you're a member of the church and you're following a good rule like we have here, and every night you're saying, what did I do today? Did I do anything that could be a sin? You know, And once a year, maybe you read like an extensive examination of conscience, just so you can keep people fresh in their mind. Once a year, like around Lent, you just read it, and you can catch stuff then too.
Yeah, I think you have a list. Well, not a list. Yeah. But your examination of conscience in your confession section.
And I have even another one that's really good, which I haven't finished editing. That's another biggie on my list. A really good. A more thorough examination of conscience, I think from the SSP 10 or from one of these groups. It's pretty good, but it's got a lot of bad stuff in there. So I got to edit out the scrupulous and the bad stuff or the liberal stuff and then bring it back up and put it on my site. Because that is an important thing, to have a good extensive examination of conscience. And if you did that once a year, you're going to remember it for the whole year. And then every night when you're doing your compline, you sit back and you say, what did I do today? Is there anything I did today that could equate to a sin? And if you're not sure, ask God to confirm it. And then you may find up, you wake up the next day and your Bible read, it happens a lot with us. You open up your Bible and there it is. God's telling you right in the Bible. He either says, no, it's not a sin, or yes, it is a sin. And the reading of the Bible is such a powerful, a lot of people are afraid to read the Old Testament too, which is crazy. And you can't really be a Christian without reading the Old and the New, because the Old Testament's still being fulfilled, a lot of your prophecies, and a lot of it gives you a side of God that you need to know about God. And if you don't read the Old Testament, you're not a Christian. You can't be a Christian. And there's a lot of people that despise the Old Testament because they think he's a vengeful, he's a vicious, vengeful God, you know. You had that one guy, Steve Allen, he was a comedian Jew, and he says the first time he read the Bible, and he's a Jew, so he's reading the Old Testament, he says, God's a homicidal maniac. God's crazy. This is what the guy Steve Allen is saying. He says, no, you're crazy. People are the homicidal maniacs, not God. But this is the typical impression of people who think they're living in like utopia and everybody's good.
When I was doing my research throughout the different faiths and different Catholic groups out there, I never was able to reconcile the Old and New Testament until I came to yourself. You were able to bridge, like, Jesus, it's the same God. Jesus is the same God. But
and
just have a completely different tone to it. But he is the same. And
you know why? Because we were raised to despise the Old Testament. We all were that way. First of all, we were raised to despise the whole Bible. So we didn't even read the Bible. And if we did, as nominal Catholics, you would only read the New Testament. And the Old Testament was like, forget it. He's a barbaric God. That's the way we were trained. They separated it into two different gods because they didn't want you to know about how wrathful God is. He's that way in the New Testament too. But the point was already made in the Old Testament. Now, Jesus is coming for mercy and redemption and forgiveness, but he's also got wrath. But the Old Testament is so powerful. It is so, you know what I compare it to? If you guys were to look at one of those good movies I have and you turn it on like halfway into the movie and you just started watching it and you don't know who the characters are, you don't know the reasons, you don't know why, and you're losing like half of the movie. The whole thing doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. And so unless you read both Testaments, forget about it. And my Bible reading program is set up in such a way so that within 2 days you're reading parts from every part of the Bible and the prophets and the prophecies and how they're being fulfilled. And then you start wanting to learn what's the tribes of Jacob? What are their names? Who were their sons' names? What did their sons do? You know, you want to learn everything about it. You're just so the way of God, you know. And you read the church fathers, they are like, the Old Testament is like is right at their lips. They loved it. They quoted it. They spoke about it all the time. And they equally with the New Testament. But when we grew up, and this started back, I think, in the Protestant time when they had to stop reading the Bibles around 1400, 1500. Because if we started reading the Bibles, we're going to condemn what these Renaissance antipopes were doing. So they taught us to despise the Old Testament. And therefore, we never knew the true God. No, you don't. Until you study both testaments, and as we have these great movies you'll have on the Bibles. Oh, excellent! David, Solomon, Samson, Abraham, Moses, Bulwarks, Joseph. If those movies don't move you, then I don't know. Then your spirit. Yeah, go ahead.
I would say the Old Testament is very difficult to read at times.
Go ahead.
I don't know. I'd almost prefer to, dare I say, read a Protestant Bible that's simplified. Do you know?
No. If you read a good, even the Douay Rheims, even though it stinks and it got a lot of errors in it, there's parts in the Bible that you really can almost skip over. When they're talking about like the temple and they had the golden candlestick with the silver, and then they got the pot that's over here, or when they start talking about the genealogies. And they're going in. That stuff you can sort of skip over. Although the first time I read the Bible, I read all of that. But it's kind of dry. It's kind of dry because they're getting into. But I was even interested in that because I wanted to know the historical facts of how did the temple look? What did they have in the temple? The genealogies can get a little dry. But you'll find out the other stuff, though, becomes more and more comprehensible the more you pray and the more you're studying and the more you're faithful. And that's what I said in the beginning when you're reading the Bible. If you get to a passage that's hard to understand, just pass it over. Don't kill yourself over it. Don't try to, I got to figure this out. Just pass it over and just keep reading and you'll pick stuff up later on. Don't think you got to understand everything or send you're going to be stuck on one verse for like 20 minutes and you're never going to get it. And that's so that even when I first read the Bible, that's what I did. So I didn't understand something because it was worded kind of wrong. I would keep reading it. And then now I'm beginning to understand something over here. And then you'd find out, now I know what he meant over here because of what he said over there. So that's a big thing. I hope I wrote that in my thing. I think I probably did too. Don't get stuck on stuff you don't understand. Just pass it over and keep reading the Bible. And then you'll find out when you read it back again the second time, it'll start making sense. You know, you'll start to understand it. And a good go ahead.
The old English, you know, that kind of way. I'd always prefer this to be said in a modern way, if you get me.
But the old English, it's not like when I'm reading the even like the Douay Rheims and they got like the, it's not so old, you know, like the old English. If we looked at old English, it's almost like another language. But It
I almost feel like the Douay Rheims is better than the King James in that department, because the Douay Rheims is actually the revision from like 1750, whereas the King James is from like 1600. So it's even like 150 years closer to modern English.
Yeah, to me,
it's even easier to read.
Yeah, you're right. It is. It's not hard. Thouest speaketh it. You get used to that. So I like it even, really. I think it's more holier sounding, more reverent sounding, that older English. You know, I don't use it when I write and all that. I know I'm a, but for the Bible, I think it just seems more respectful. And thouest and hear it. Go ahead.
Your commentaries are excellent on your Bible translation.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
Bible commentaries are excellent.
Yeah, that's Phil's bringing up a good point. What I did, and Thomas, this addresses what you're saying. When I first read the Bible, I didn't understand a lot in it neither. I mean, there's passage, the Old Testament. There's a lot, even sometimes in the New. There's stuff I said, but I'm going to pass, because you know why people stop reading the Bible? They get to a few verses they don't understand and they quit and they give up. So I said, I'm not giving up. I'm going to, because I was getting a lot of good stuff out of it anyway. I'm going to read through the parts I don't understand. But that led me to have a good Catholic commentary on passages that are difficult to understand and could really, and even the ones that I read from Haydock, he has good commentaries too. Maybe 70% of his commentaries are good. 30% stink, but there's still some good commentaries that helped me when I was reading, even though there was some, and I knew the heresies too when I was reading them too, because I went, well, no, this is crazy. But then there's a lot of stuff in the commentary that was good. And it helps you to understand the stuff that you couldn't understand when you're reading it. But and you'll find out as the more you start reading the Bible, and you the second time you read it through, you're picking up more stuff. We even say here with the brothers, as much as I've been reading the Bible, you still pick up new stuff. It never ends. God's always showing you new stuff. He's enlightening you with new thoughts. But go ahead.
See what you think. There's a Protestant YouTube channel called The Bible Project, and what they do is they have each book of the Bible, they have a video commentary with like a comic book. So they have like all the verses laid out in this on the scroll, and you can see the images for each like section of the book, and he's talking about it, and it's just really easy to follow. And within a week, you could have the whole Bible summarized pretty close. Well, I'm not sure about what heresies they're teaching.
Well, that's something. I
do recommend that to people. I don't know what you think of that.
Well, you got to be careful. The reason you got to be careful is because all they need to do is have a few heresies in there, and it's going to ruin what they're reading. They're going to pick up a heresy or going to pick up something that should have been in there that's not in there. And here's another problem with that. The minute you start authorizing all different kinds of Bibles, I'll give you an example as you're talking about this today. We get this nominal Catholic brochure, and they sell stuff, Ignatius Press. And literally, on the sections on Bibles, he has like 10 Bibles in there, maybe more. The New American Bible, the Old American Bible, the Ignatius Bible, the New Way Bible, the Easy Bible, and he's got like 10 Bibles in there. And I'm going, what the heck is going on here? And this leaves open abuses, mistranslations, inaccuracies. And when you're talking about the Bible, like they try to make it, let's speak in modern English, sort of leave it, they're not really literally interpreting it, that's horrible. Just interpret the Bible in English strictly, in good English, but don't start making things up and trying to make it easier and you're leaving stuff out. I hate that. There's only one necessity for one Bible. That's it. That's what I'm working on. That's the Bible I'm making. And if I was the Pope, and if I am going to be the next Pope, that what I would say is, every Bible has to be translated from this original Bible from Rome. Nobody gets to make a new Bible, another Bible, 10 Bibles, 2 Bibles. There's one Bible. And if anybody has a problem with the Bible that's legitimate, write to Rome, write to the Pope. He'll look at it with his people and he'll correct it. He'll correct it. But you cannot have all these different Bibles. You just can't. It's chaos.
Yeah. That size is not like a particular Bible version or anything. They're just giving them a general synopsis of
that's
Bible.
Something different. Yeah. Like you're saying, like it's a book like telling the Bible stories without really reading the Bible. That's something different.
Yeah, Ryan might have a comment. I see you unmuted there.
So Richard, I'm just wondering, like, regarding something like the Dead Sea Scrolls, do you necessarily trust that when like they say, oh, we found, you know, these missing lost manuscripts trips in the desert, or, you know, it's more correct. Would you necessarily, I mean, I guess you'd have to study it on a case-by-case basis, but
well, here's
I'm
what,
thinking,
yeah,
my thinking is that that kind of thing is going to happen closer and closer to the reign of the Antichrist.
Yeah.
Oh, we dug it up in the desert. This is actually the real original.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. You got to watch out for that. Here's what I think about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I'd have to study it more, though. Okay. So it could even, if you want to have a really good phony, I'm not saying they're phony, but if you want to have a really good fake thing, you have a lot of truth in it. And you go, hey, well, look, it matches. And then you throw the curveball. Now, with the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think they were done by the Essenes in the desert, and they were Stoics. So I would question, I'm not saying it's not authentic. It probably is. But if it's coming from the Essenes, this Jewish sect that were Stoics, and they separated from the temple, went out into the desert, those are the ones that are on Masada when it was taken down. Well, then you got to worry about their translation of the Bible, you know? Like, if they're Stoics, you can trust some of the stuff, and some of the stuff you can't trust, like the Masoretic text of the Jews who denied Christ, the modern Jewish Masoretic text since they denied Christ. Some stuff in it is accurate, where it doesn't involve Christianity. But you got to be very suspicious of any verses that involve Christianity and Jesus directly, with that they can pervert. So you're right. You got to be on guard about them finding these things. I made a joke about that somewhere once, or the archaeologists are finding all stuff to discredit the Bible, you know, or maybe to prove the Jewish point and disprove the Christian point. And I think I had a lecture on that somewhere. And I was talking, remember you were saying, like, the guy, they were doing like an excavation. They said, hey, we found something down here. Hey, what's a Budweiser can doing there? Well, when you guys drinking here last night? You know, you didn't dig that up, did you? Because if it's a Budweiser can, it's a modern thing, you know. And, hey, I got a Budweiser can next to this relic. So they got a lot of stuff you can't trust. But
people misinterpret the Bible. Like in the New Testament, people misinterpret things. Like they always say, like, oh, let... They always use, like, oh, against the death penalty is usually the main one. And they always say, oh, he was without sin cast the first stone.
Yeah, yeah.
And how would I refute that?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Luke 19:27, right away. Jesus said, as those for my enemies that will not have me rule over them, bring them hither and kill them before me. That's Jesus speaking. And kill them before me. And then you have St. Paul saying, in Hebrews 10, I got about 5 verses that support the death penalty and killing people in the New Testament.
See my article, Brief on Just Wars and Capital and Corporal Punishment, on the RJMI's article menu on the St. John the Baptist website.
So Jesus is talking about rash judgments, judgments without mercy. Look at yourself first before you judge someone else. Don't be so quick to be killing people. Don't be so quick to go out and revenge people if it's a personal thing. Make sure you have a just cause. And that's what he's saying in context. Yeah. You can do that in the Bible. The Protestants do that when you quote Romans 10, he who believes in Jesus is saved. Okay, that's it. All right.
Nine.
I don't got to do anything else. Oh, whoa. What about Mark 16:16? He who believes and is baptized is saved. Oh. Oh, what about... I think it's Matthew 19:7. Jesus said, if thou unto life, keep the commandments. Oh, what about that? So you can take one Bible verse out of context purposely, and if you're not reading the rest of the Bible, if you know about it, you're dishonest. Now, you can catch a nominal Catholic because he doesn't read the Bible, and you can throw him off guard, and you could disarm him. And they do that today. The liberals do that. They quote all the verses out of context and leave out all the verses that have to do with wrath, justice, revenge, just killings, obedience of wives to their husbands. They leave all these verses out, and they take them out of context. I have at least...
That Mark 16 verse that you brought up is actually a perfect example of what I was talking about a second ago, because it says, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved.
Yeah.
And apparently, the last, like, quarter of chapter 16 is not in a lot of the early manuscripts.
Yeah.
And so the Protestants that don't believe baptism is necessary will say, oh, see, it's a later edition. It's not,
yeah, but then we quote, you're right, they do that too. Then we quote John 3:5. Unless man's born of water and the Holy Spirit, he can't enter the kingdom of heaven. John 3:5. And so he's nailed on John 3:5.
Right.
He can't throw out the whole Bible. You know, that's amazing. They try to do that with faith and works, so they threw out St. James. St. James isn't the only one that said faith without works is dead. The whole Bible's loaded with it. Thousands of the New Testament verses. So you can throw out James if you want, but I got that one. The best I love, St. Paul says, He says, not the hearers of the law shall be justified before God, but the doers of the law. Romans 2:13. The biggest one is the, is it Matthew 19:17? Jesus speaking, if thou enter into life, keep the commandments. And they have that in their own Bibles. But, you know, so it's amazing. If they really have to, eventually, I think they say Thomas Jefferson did this in his country. He chopped out almost the whole Bible. He made his whole Bible. He was chopping out huge passages of the whole New Testament. Miracles and stuff. He had his own Bible. He didn't believe in miracles. So anytime there's a miracle, he chopped it out.
I think you said before about the woman getting stoned, that Jesus knew her heart and he gave her a dispensation.
Yes, he did. You're right. Jesus being merciful to the adulterous woman proves the death penalty was even enforced then. Then, what does mercy mean? Mercy means I'm mitigating justice. Mercy means I'm mitigating a justified law, but I'm going to have mercy. So what's the justified law? Adultery is a death penalty. But in your case, because your accusers are worse than you and they're hypocrites, and I see your repentance, I'm going to have mercy and dispense from the death penalty.
And it proves his omnipotence as well.
Of course. No, God himself, you know, knowing hearts perfectly as God does. So King David committed adultery during the Old Testament, which on the law was death. But he was dispensed from the death penalty. It's so important. This Bible I come out, which is going to have all of that in there, you know, and I might have it up there already on my briefs. I think I probably do. But when you read it, it is so important. So you got the thing like Shannon was just saying about taking Bible verses out of context by reading one verse, but ignoring 10 other verses that contradict what their translation is. And then we get back to the Bible text itself, where I'm almost done with it, too. That's going to be one of my I may be climbing a mountain for that one also, but that you only need one Bible. Think about when you have 20 Bibles and 20 Roman missals, and everybody can make their own Roman missal. This bishop can make his. This bishop can make his. Now that the Holy See, the papacy's got to look at like 20 different Bibles, 20 different Roman missals, have everybody correcting 20 missals. It's crazy. It should never have been allowed. The Pope is the one that's in charge of the church. He's the one that authorizes a Bible. And anybody who wants a correction to that Bible has to go through the papacy. They have to write into the Holy See and say, hey, you know, you probably missed this, but Deuteronomy 32:35 should be this instead of that. Fine. Then the Pope looks at it. He makes the change. So now you've got this one Bible coming from this one source, one Bible. And everybody has to translate that accurately in other languages and not leave out one jot or one tittle. Or not leave out anything or not add anything to that one Bible. And then now we have uniformity.
What would you say about, I'm not sure if you mentioned in the book, you know, when Jerome, he was doing the Bible and he used the Masoretic text, like you were saying, and that had errors, and St. Augustine said, don't use the Masoretic, all these things. But the church ended up using that, and that would have been, what, the 4th, 5th century?
No, they didn't use it in the 4th, 6th century. Not only till, they didn't use it until later on, even till maybe 900 or even 1100, they didn't really, as an official text. Jerome's text took a long time to be, Gregory, I have some problems with Pope Gregory, I still call him Pope St. Gregory the Great, but not the Great, I call him the First. He's the first one that sort of used it, but he only used it, it wasn't the official text. He just said, I referred to this text because in some ways it's better, but he never made it the official text. The official text was still the Old Latin, which is translated from the Septuagint for the Old Testament, and the Old Latin that in regards to the New Testament. That was the official Bible for a long time. Jerome's Bible wasn't accepted right away, if you read the whole story. Go ahead.
What was the name?
What was that?
Go ahead. That one that the Latin... One that used
to it's called the Old Latin.
The Latin version that used
to it's called the Old Latin, or the Vulgata, and it was taken off. It was a Latin translation of Septuagint.
And why did they update it if it suffice?
That was the whole problem. When Jerome was doing this work, the New Testament, he didn't mess up too much because that one wasn't really too bad. But he mangled that. Now, we really don't even have Jerome's original thing. So that's lost even. So whatever they had at the time of the Council of Trent, they're saying we don't even know if this is Jerome's original, but it was still the biggest problem was he used the Masoretic text as the template. That was the main text. Now, you could refer to the Masoretic text as a reference source in areas where you do not suspect the Jews are going to deny something about Christianity. So you could still use it as a reference point, but the Septuagint had to be the main template because errors crept into the Septuagint. So what you want to do is, the Septuagint is what I'm working with. And if I got a problem in a version of the Septuagint, I'm going to first look at the Church Fathers. I'm going to look at the Syriac version of the Old Latin, the other Old Latin verses, and then I'm going to look at the Church Fathers and then correct the Septuagint. And I'll even look at the Masoretic text. I'll look at that too. And then if I need to correct the Septuagint, I'm going to correct the Septuagint. He didn't do that. He used the Jewish Masoretic text as its basis for the Old Testament, which is horrible. And the Pope that did not authorize him only to do the New Testament. When he took on the Old Testament, that's when he got into all big kinds of troubles.
Brother Richard.
Yeah.
Remember the Exodus verse in your recent video about...
About the life in the womb, when life begins in the womb? Yeah, that was a big one. The Jews mangled that one to make you believe life doesn't begin in the womb. I meant you'd have to read my book, Life Begins in the Womb, and you'll see how bad the Clementine Vulgate is on that. Horrible. The Masoretic text. It copies the Jewish belief that some Jews believe life doesn't begin until the baby's born and takes his first breath. So, of course, then you can abort them, right? I mean, you're not committing murder, at least. So I go over that, and the life begins in the womb.
They changed the version of self-conceived, too, to young woman self-conceived.
Oh, yes, exactly. Now, there's another one you got to be suspicious of with the Masoretic text, obviously, because they want to deny the verses that refer to Christ. So I still refer to the Masoretic text, too, when I have trouble on certain verses, but it's just a reference point. But the first place I go is the Septuagint. Then I'll go to the Syriac, the Peshittal versions, which is the Syriac translation of the Septuagint. Then I go to the Old Latin, which is the Versi Antiqua, and I compare it to the Clementine Vulgate, and believe it, and then I go to the Church Fathers, and I look with how they quote the verse, and I don't go to the English translations. I'll go into their Latin translations to see if it matches. And that's how you... And now, when I'm done with this Bible, believe me, there's still going to be a lot of stuff that needs to be corrected. But what I think I got out of it is the heresies and the major problems. I'm almost sure I corrected all of them. So those are corrected. The ones where you have some major, serious, heavy-duty problems regarding heresy or misstatements of historical facts. I do believe I got all those out. And so it's as clean a version as we're going to have to date when that one goes out.
Just a question on the life begins in the womb, Richard. Right, the soul enters the baby's body normally, what, around 40 something days?
Yeah.
So if a baby is aborted before that, what type of sin is committed?
Okay, I think I mentioned in my book if it's not your fault, if it's an abortion though, I call it first it's mutilation, all right, it's contraception.
I'm reading from my book, Life Begins in the Womb. If an abortion takes place before the soul is created within the body, the following mortal sins are committed by those who obtain, participate in, or condone these abortions. The mortal sin of contraception, the mortal sin of denying that procreation, the beginning of children, is the primary purpose of relations between man and woman. The mortal sin of stealing for stealing a body that was being prepared for a soul to enter into. You can call the offenders body snatchers. The mortal sin of unjust mutilation, which is a mortal sin against the fifth commandment. And the mortal sin of murder by intent for those who obtain, participate, or condone abortion and believe that life begins at conception. Even though the murder is not committed, they believe it is committed because they believe that life begins at conception.
So like a lot of these modernist, liberal, you would say, or leftist ideas and concepts coming into like the 20th, 21st century, they're all actually old Talmudic Jewish beliefs. Like the apostate Jews believe that there's the six genders. They believe in pedophilia. They believe in, I think they believe in bestiality, things like that.
Yeah.
And abortion and the baby's not a human until it's born.
Yeah.
So all of these like these protected movements and stuff that are coming in the LGBT, they're every single last one of those beliefs are all apostate Jewish beliefs. after Christ. They're old to deny Christ. And that was their origin.
Yeah, that's interesting what you're mentioning there, because from the perspective you're saying, it does. You're right. It fits the transgenders, it fits the homos, bestiality, and they also believe, if I'm not mistaken, even to some degree, that God the Father is like a woman, is feminine, and that the soul comes from your mother. The mother, your soul comes not from God but from your mother, and so that's the matriarchal heresy line. So you got feminism, sexual perversion, genderism, all this from the Talmud. Think about that in the Kabbalah. I never thought about it from that perspective. That's the Antichrist supporting his perversions while he tries to pretend he's going to be the Messiah from the Old Testament, the Torah, or the whole Old Testament, which they think is goofy. They don't like the Torah. They think it's a silly, but it's for women and young kids, the Torah, you know? And they even perverted that too.
Mad.
Yeah, it's crazy. But the Bible thing, though, that's why it's so big. When if I get the right commentaries in there, it's going to help the people where they have difficulty. But reading the Old Testament, the more and more you read it, you'll see the better, more and more you're going to understand it. And there's a lot of parts in it you could, like, I'd say 85% of the Old Testament you can understand when you're reading it. 15% you may have difficulty. Just read it through and don't try to figure it out. Just keep reading. And it'll either come to you later on, or it'll come to you the second time you read through the scripture a year later or something.
So I'm not sure if I heard correctly, but the problem I'm having is why aren't we using the Bible that you, as you said, the old Latin text? Like, what was wrong with that?
No, the Septuagint had errors creeping into it, right? And they did. And so then if you're taking the old Latin off the Septuagint that has errors, and maybe even the old Latin has errors, but there were three versions to the Septuagint and several different versions to the old Latin. So the problem was they needed to have corrected the Septuagint. The problem was using the Masoretic text, not the Septuagint, as the template when you're correcting it. You don't say, let's take a look at this apostate Jewish Old Testament and use that as our Bible and work from there. You say, let's, because that has way more errors. The Septuagint had way less errors and was way more accurate and was the one Jesus Christ authorized, but then it crept in through copies. So you should have came out and said, we're going to correct the Septuagint, not the Masoretic text. That's the problem. Corrections needed to be made to the Septuagint, go ahead. Yeah.
The question is based on, the church should have the official Bible. End of story.
That's right.
And I suppose what you're really saying is that there's no heresies taught in the old Latin text.
Not that I don't know about heresies. The errors I'm catching in the Septuagint, I didn't catch any heresies, but there are errors. There's definitely errors in the Septuagint. Yeah. A few of them, but not many. But they're there. There's some errors, but not many compared to the Masoretic and the other text. Horrible. And these texts
would be an issue if the early church were using the heretical Bible.
Yeah, I didn't so far. I mean, I didn't read the whole Septuagint yet myself, even. But that's the first place I go when I'm correcting the one we have today. And my other this is frustrating for me because I've been working on this for years now, for I don't know how many years. But then I was going to sit down and just start all over again with the Septuagint. Christ will come the second time, the world will be over by then. I don't have time to do it. But I do refer to it, and I know from reading what the parts I have read, very minor errors compared to the Clementine Vulgate, and nothing that I found yet that is heretical. But like historical stuff, it shouldn't have been number 10 instead of the number 100, or there's a few other things maybe they weren't 100% accurate on. But the church really didn't embrace these Clementine Vulgate, the they call the Jerome one, until way later on. There was a lot of opposition to it during his lifetime and many years after that. Gregory the First was the first one that gave it some justification, a little bit. But he didn't really say this is the new text. He just said there's some things in this Latin translation of Jerome's that we can accept that are better than the Septuagint, which is probably true, some things. But he never made it the official text. And even at the time of Trent, by that time that happened, they didn't even have the original of Jerome's translation, but they had a whole bunch of different ones out there. And so they wanted to, see, when I wrote the book on the Bible, it's not bad that he wanted to have one Bible. That's true. You should, I mean, to want to have the one clan and say, this is it, fine. But that's the Bible you pick? That's the one you choose? Which has like massive, massive, multiple, obvious errors and heresies in it? It's embarrassing. So the motive was correct, but the Bible you chose was stupid. And then they lied about it so many different ways. Bellarmine, when they came out with the first version, Sixtus the Fifth, he tried to say, oh, he never promulgated it, but he did promulgate it. He absolutely did. And then when Clement the 13th promulgated the Clementine Vulgate, he said, this is clean of errors. This is just, I mean, we declare and decree. I mean, it's crazy. It sort of like undermined. There was even one pope, I forget who it was, Sixtus the Fourth or the Fifth, maybe the Fifth even, who said, and he admitted, that why don't we just go back and use your Septuagint and make it a lot easier? And all the theologians went against him. They yelled at him, no. And so he backed off, and he didn't use the Septuagint. What a mess. But that's why you need a church also. Go ahead. Yeah.
We were talking earlier, you said that the genealogies are kind of dry. I actually did a really in-depth study on the genealogies because I was trying to figure out the exact age of the earth.
Yeah, I like that. I saw you wrote something on that. I know if you're motivated, that's a good reason why you want to study that too. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, what I was going to say was that you should. I made a whole video actually. And I would like for you to watch that before you release the official version of your Bible.
Good, so okay.
The exact numbers in there.
Good, okay. I'll look at it. The reason my opinion was still the 4,000 new, 2,000 old, based upon what the church fathers believed. I don't know if it's unanimous, though. It may not be. I don't think it's unanimous. But what I believe about the 6 days, which may not match what you have, but then what is your come to, about 10,000 years, you think the whole thing is? 10,000? What did you end up with?
No, it's around 7,200.
Okay, yeah, which is all within legitimate range. I think I said anywhere between 6,000 and 10,000, I would say is an accurate, acceptable opinion. But when you start talking like a million years, and you know, when they start doing that stuff, 20,000 years, 30,000 years, then you're getting crazy. But you know what, Ryan, too, interesting, but I don't know if I got time, but I wish I would. You notice like in the Septuagint, I think they had an error. They said that all the patriarchs didn't have kids till they were 100 years old. And that, but in the Clementine Vulgate, it doesn't say that.
No, that's one of the things that they had right.
Yeah, but maybe they did.
That's one of the things they had right in the Septuagint.
I don't know. How do we know that?
They didn't
though?
Have kids until they were like 100 something.
Yeah, but other church fathers say different.
Because the Septuagint is older than the Masoretic.
I'm not using the Masoretic. I'm talking about the Old Latin. Some of the church fathers who were not using the Masoretic used the Old Latin, and they didn't have 100 years. So I didn't study it, though.
So it must have been changed in the Old Latin, too. Though.
Yeah, right.
Because actually, you're going to have to watch my thing on it, without that, it creates contradictions and stuff too. So.
Yeah, and because it does extend the period with the 100. The thing I thought weird about that, my opinion was the Septuagint was wrong, and I could be wrong myself. But here's why I thought it was wrong, because it was every one they didn't have a kid that are 100 years old. That's kind of weird. Like you're married, like
it doesn't say that they didn't have kids until 100 something. It says they had this kid.
Okay. And so how come they're all having the chosen kid that's going to be counted at 100 years old? Why didn't one come around 70 or 60 or 50? See, it was kind of weird to me, because when you look at the other interpretations, it would say so-and-so had the kid when he was 40. This one had the kid when he was 50. This one had the kid when he was 80. This one had the kid when he was 100. And so they'd have a varying ages. And Augustine used that one with the 100, 100, 100, 100. I know he used that, but I question it, you know. Now, I don't know if I'm going to have time to study that whole thing, and that's why I still think it's a legitimate opinion, anywhere from 6,000 to 10,000 years. But one day, if I have spare time, but I ain't going to listen to what you put on there. And I would even put your thing up as a viable opinion, and then people can choose whatever they want. It's not heresy, because the church hasn't judged on it. We'd have to study it. And I don't even know. You're right. It was just so suspicious to me that, okay, every important person that's coming from a patriarch is they're not having to kill till they're 100 years old. Nobody in 70, nobody. It was just, it seemed kind of weird to me. But that is the section that extends. Yeah, yeah, go ahead, Ryan. And I don't know.
I just said yeah.
Yeah, and
There's a scientific fact in the at the very beginning of Genesis, and it says that Adam was made from the like clay of the earth, the slime of the earth, or whatever. That it actually proves that biblically that that's from God, because we're carbon based life forms.
Yeah.
So and that was only a later discovery, so that we're all made from carbon. So we were made. He made us from the material of the earth. You know.
Yeah.
The carbon.
Yeah. And also, what we say about that, when the people see, they do crazy. When you look at a strict Bible chronology, a lot of your evolutionist people that think the world's a billion years old, they don't realize that God created the world old. That's what we say. He created an old world. If God created a full-grown tree in front of you, let's say a 100-year-old tree, and he can create, snap his finger, there's the tree. You'd say the tree's 100 years old, but it's not. It's only 1 second old. God just created the world old. So that eliminates the evolutionist heretics, bastards, that, you know, about the evolution before even Adam came to be. But the questions we're talking about on chronology had to do, okay, well, let's start with Adam and then go forward. Then you could still have discrepancies from that even, which I put between 6 to 10,000 years of legitimate opinions on that area when you're looking at, and it's very worthy what you did there, Ryan, to do that. And that took a lot of work, and I could see me wanting to do something like that, but never having the time to do it. And that's what you can trace all the generations and tracing all that. And it's interesting work. And it's commendable work. But what we refute, and what you said there, God created Adam out of the slime. He did not evolve. He created him out of the slime. And he made Eve from the rib of Adam. And, you know, lest we say, us Catholics can answer, when they say, who what came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, anybody who's a believer can tell you that. The chicken came first. Then the egg came later. It's not, they made like it was a big mystery when we were growing up, right? My nominal Catholic parents would pose that question to me, these jackasses that never read the Bible. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Huh? Oh, I wasn't reading the Bible. If you read the Bible, the chicken, you stupid jerk. Male chicken, female chicken, they mate, and oh, we got an egg. Okay. We found out that about 35% of my commentaries, and the commentaries in the Clementine Vulgate, can be removed once you get the true translation from the Septuagint. The Septuagint answers it. Yeah. You don't even need a commentary. And the reason they needed a commentary is to explain their mistranslated verse that makes no sense. It's crazy, the stuff I come up against. It's amazing. Genealogy is rough stuff, you know, and that's why St. Paul even said, sometimes the Jews would be more concerned about genealogies than some dogmas on faith or morals. Those are historical dogmas in a sense. Historically, it's good to know it. But I think what he's saying with the Jews too, because they were trying to prove their Jewishness, how holy they were because they're Jews, you know, or because they came from a holy Jewish tribe or a holy noble family or something. So, but genealogies does have its place. And that's probably one of your most complicated. And I really do have a lot of respect for people that are archaeologists, genealogists. And I try to do some of this. I don't have time to do a lot. And historians, if you're reading the Bible, I used to say, how come I got to know the exact day something? Maybe the year, like, let's say 1557, but May 7th, or was it May 8th, or was it May 9th? And then when you're studying history, you do need to know that under certain circumstances, because it can indict somebody as, did he do this before this happened or after that happened? So I have a lot of respect for educated people. I do. Even though I condemn scholastics, I don't condemn education nor the mind. And God gave us a mind to use it and to learn. And I have a lot of respect for these professors, these good professors that study these things, that are at least the honest ones, not the ones that are dishonest. Okay, any other questions?
It's actually something I wanted to mention to you a while ago about, you know, the ancient Hebrew, not only did it have a numerical value for each letter, it also had pictorial value or pictorial meaning.
Interesting.
I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No.
And believe it or not, it actually reveals Christ in the very first word in the Bible.
Ah, that's interesting. And I'm sure God has a lot of examples like that in different ways. It's amazing too how when you're watching the St. Patrick movie, and it's not just St. Patrick, but it does it with all pagans, how God sees true prophecies among the pagan religions. So that when the Christ comes, or they hear about him, or like even he said, Patrick, this day was foretold that someone's going to come to this island, and so God sees prophecies amongst the pagans, even and the Vikings, and
see the Zoroastrians or something you call them. They have the same thing about a son of God or something like that as well.
Yeah.
Do you think that would have been something, a prophecy revealed to them?
They do. God seeds them in all these religions so that when the true religion comes, they can look back and say, hey, look, we had a kernel of this truth. Part of this was told to us. Something was told to us. And so when they get Christianity, or back in the Old Testament, when the true faith was preached to them under the Old Covenant, which was Judaism, or before that, the faith of Abraham and the faith of Noah. So when it was preached to them, they would understand. And so God's always working like that. With the prophecy, seeding them in there. In other words, which is how, if anybody's really of goodwill, there's no, well, that's the thing on predestination too that I got into. But
I'll send you this video. It's incredibly fascinating. Each letter has, I just have the notes here loaded up here. Each letter has a pictorial meaning. So the first word of the Bible is Bereshit bara Elohim, which means in the beginning God created. And so the letter take the word bara, for example.
Yeah,
you'll notice bara is inside that.
Yeah,
and bara, as we know, is son.
Yeah,
and that word is son of the commandment, bar mitzvah is son of the commandment. And so immediately you have bara in there as bara, and that is created. That's the word created.
Go ahead.
Now, the very first word, though, bereshit, also contains bara, B or A.
I don't think the Jews are going to like that too much.
I got this maybe from a Protestant, actually, and this is where I do actually would listen to sometimes their material and just take...
I still do. I still listen to them occasionally, the preachers. Occasionally to see what they believe in and see what they're not believing in and where they stand. I listen to all. I listen to the Messianic Jews. I listen to get you angry, but especially the Zionist ones. But you listen to all these people. And I'll tell you one thing. It's like I said before, though. At least the Protestants are interested in scriptures. I'm sure Ryan, I don't know about Ryan's parents, but my nominal Catholic parents, if you spoke about the faith to them, they don't even care. The Bible, it's like you're talking Chinese. If you talk to a Protestant, you're going to get somewhere. You can at least refer to certain scriptures. You have a focal point of which to talk to, an interest. And nominal Catholics don't care about the Bible at all. Nah, forget it. And they don't want
it. Here it is.
Yeah, go ahead.
Here it is.
Most nominal Catholics. Go ahead.
First word of the Bible is in beginning. It's called Bereshit. Bet, Resh, Aleph, Shin, Yod, and Tav. So Bet is like a B. And that is symbolized. And by the way, I looked at the Jewish sources. They agree that these had symbolic meanings.
Okay. Yeah, of course. Yeah, they go too far with it sometimes, but at least they agree with that. Go ahead.
So Bet is means a house or like tent. So that's like the world. Resh, the next letter, is it's like a man's head and he's looking in a certain direction. Aleph is God, or the strength of God.
Yeah.
So... immediately you have Bet Resh, which is sun, that's contained in there.
Yeah.
So Bet Resh Aleph, the head of the strength of the head of the tent is essentially what it's saying there.
Yeah.
The next letter is Shin, which means to consume. It's like teeth.
Yeah.
So to destroy or consume. And then the next letter is Yod. As you know, Jesus said, no Yod or tittle will be taken from the law.
Yeah.
And Yod is the smallest letter in the Hebrew language, and it means work or arm. And that's why it's so small. It's humble. It's like a little arm. And then the last letter is Tav, the mark. Now Tav, as we see it in modern Hebrew, it looks like an N, but in the old Hebrew, it looked like a cross.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Was the mark. That was the mark that all the angels seen when they went when he went over to all the houses. All the Hebrews had to have the mark over their house.
Why don't you write that up for me, and then I'll put your name on it, of course. that this is what you can. So I can blame you if it ends up being wrong. No, really, right?
I need the link. Explain it to me. I'm just kind of summarizing it. So basically, if you read them out in the symbolic meaning, it says the strength of the head of the tent, which is God, is consumed by his own work on the cross.
Wow. Okay, write that up and send that to me, you know? Or, you know, so I that's interesting. That's a nice little thing to put up there for a reference about Christ. So send that to me. And we got to put that up somewhere. That's interesting. The Jews aren't going to like that, but too bad. That's their problem.
The link here, I'm just going to put it in the general section. It's just a guy, he told me about this in his video. It's just fascinating stuff. Everybody should just look at it.
All right. Now, any other questions? We'll go on for about another 5 minutes. Go ahead.
I want to bring up. I have a calendar, so-called Catholic calendar. And on it, it was explaining the first rebellion in heaven when God cast out a third of the angels.
Yeah.
And apparently it was over they refused to acknowledge Christ as the Son of Man, that Christ would come as a man.
Right.
Is that true, or is that just like a story?
Yeah. Okay, here's what happened, Aaron. I wrote about that in it's in one of my books. You'll find it very interesting. I think it's Mary's God's Greatest Masterpiece. God told the angels when he first created them that in the future, he's going to have a mother, Mary, so that he can become man through Mary, that he's going to take on. He didn't talk about the crucifixion or redemption, because there would be no need of a redemption if no one ever sinned. So the first thing that they heard was, you know, as glorious as you are, Lucifer, in the future, I'm going to create a human being, and she's going to be a woman, and she's going to be my mother, and I'm going to be born of her. I'm going to come down from heaven and take on her flesh, and that's Jesus Christ. So the enmity Lucifer had was not directly towards God, because he knew God was all powerful. It was jealousy towards Mary and then to Mary's offspring, Jesus Christ, but particularly more so to even Mary. And then he looked at God as being weak when he started to sin. He started to sin when he became jealous and proud. He says, "How this creature is going to be greater than me? This woman, this human being who's lower in other characteristics, is going to be the highest creature. She's going to be above me. And you, God, are going to take on her flesh and become man? You must be." Now he's already sinning, you see. He already committed a mortal sin. He rebelled against God's will. And now he's thinking God's either weak or stupid. There's a defect in God. Why would he want to do this? And then he thought he can actually beat God. That either there's another God above him or he can become equal to God. And then the battle started. But I go over all that in my book, I think, God's Greatest...
Richard.
Yeah.
God gave Lucifer free will as well.
Yes, like all of us, everybody.
Yeah.
And
so
that's
all the angels in heaven at the minute. They have free will, but they don't want to sin because they choose not to.
Right. Once you pass the test and you end up saved, like the good angels and all the human saints, all good angels, the humans are in heaven, you'll never sin again because you never want to sin again. Your will was, God then removes the concupiscence from your flesh for us. And the good angels never had it. So they just remain the way they are, faithful and good.
Lucifer had concupiscence.
What did you say there, Shannon?
So Lucifer had concupiscence.
Lucifer didn't have any concupiscence. That's why he didn't get a second chance. The angels had no concupiscence. Only we do.
Oh, so that's why they were thrown down.
That's why they weren't given a second chance. We were given a second chance because we have concupiscence. We have devils in us since the fall, and we have Satan tempting us. That's the only reason God gave us a second chance. He never got a second chance because he didn't have concupiscence.
If that's true, then why did Adam and Eve get a second chance?
Because they did. They were tempted by the devil. The devil tempted them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because there was no temptation in heaven. So, first of all, they didn't have pure knowledge of God like Lucifer did when Adam and Eve were created. Secondly, they were tempted by the devil. Lucifer was not tempted by anybody but himself. When God created all the angels perfect and holy, there was nobody in heaven to tempt Lucifer. It was his own working. Adam and Eve's fall was also the working of the devil. So you're right. When I word that, I got to say it's not just concupiscence, but it's also temptations. That Adam and Eve were tempted by the devil. Lucifer
influenced by an external source, yeah, whereas Lucifer just influenced
all internal
by his own pride,
yeah,
and his own.
Yeah, and the other thing is that Lucifer saw the pure beauty of God. The Adam and Eve didn't see it yet. So there's two things going on there. But I think the main reason why God gave them a second chance is because of the temptation of the devil. They were aided in their fall by the devil tempting them. But no one tempted Lucifer. His pure rebellion came from himself, right from within. And the good angels who remain good, they remain good. They can never go bad again. And they never will go bad. But what I was talking about concupiscence is when a human being saves his soul and goes to heaven, then God wipes. If we still have concupiscence in our flesh and devils in us tempting us, there's a danger there. There's a problem with that. But that doesn't exist in heaven. And it doesn't exist in the new paradise to come. And because your will was already set to obey God in all things, and now you're not being tempted by anybody, and now you have a glorified body, you'll never sin again. Lucifer had no temptation from but himself. And he didn't have no concupiscence because there was no sin. He was the first one who sinned. Him. It came from him and all the other angels that followed him. They all had the same instinct, the same rebellion within them. What I was talking about was with us, when we go to heaven, if we're never going to sin again, we got to get rid of our concupiscent flesh. We're no longer going to have devils tempting us anymore. That's what happens when we're saved. He never had that. He never had temptations or concupiscence. So that when he sinned, it was way more grievous than when Adam and Eve sinned. And he had firsthand knowledge of God face to face in heaven. Yeah, if you read my book, God's Greatest Masterpiece, Mary and Lucifer's Fall, it's all in there. Everything I just mentioned is in there. It's all in there. And the whole point I make in that book is that the root of Lucifer's fall was not rebellion against God directly, but against God through Mary. He was jealous of Mary, who was that, and then God himself, who was going to become man through Mary. He couldn't believe it. He was jealous too, because God told him, in the future, I'm going to have a mother that I'm going to create, and she's going to be the greatest creature ever, and I'm going to take on her flesh and become a human nature. I'm going to take on a human nature through her. There it is. Lucifer heard it, and he didn't accept it. He didn't accept it because at that time, he was the greatest, most perfect, and the number one guy in heaven. He wanted to remain that way, and he didn't want Mary to take his place. And if you read my book, it's all in there. All right, now. Oh, Shannon, you mentioned there was a new thing on signs and false signs and wonders, a new movie or something.
Oh, it's like I don't even watch it yet. It's on. It was on Netflix, and it was called Midnight Mass.
Yeah.
And it was about a priest who's seeing an angel, like a normal sort of a priest, and he's seeing this angel, and it's doing all these like false miracles.
Yeah.
But it's actually a demon.
Okay.
But it's got like a Catholic sort of background. There's people saying that it's anti-Christian. Then there's people saying that it's pro-Christian. It's just against.
Yeah, false.
So I can imagine the Novus Ordo people would say that it was anti-Christian.
Yeah, just like the
I could probably.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I can imagine like it's sort of like touches on the people that you know the major gory sort of thing and things like that, like false.
Well, like
false Catholic.
Yeah, we brought in The Unholy. I brought that one in where I already edited that and completed it. That was a good one. The Unholy. That refutes all the false apparitions. That's a powerhouse. They're gonna hate that one in the Novus Ordo. And even the traditionalists are going to hate that one because it's
Norma's Ordo hates that one.
Oh, they're going to hate it. They're going to hate the movie, the Catholics. They're going to hate any movie. The Borgias, they're going to hate. The Renaissance people are going to hate the Borgias movie. And I'll tell you, you look at that 12-part series, and I'm going to tell you something. Not only is it true what happened in there, he was even worse than what you saw in the movie, okay? And so, I mean, you don't like it too bad. That's the truth. If it's exposing a horrible thing, like the movie, what was the one about exposed to pedophilia from the guys in Boston?
Oh, Spotlight.
Spotlight. That's a really good one.
Spotlight.
Spotlight. It exposes.
I watched that Believers movie last
year. Yeah.
Week,
well, that was.
And I thought that was brilliant. That's that. Was Santeria or something?
Yeah,
or?
Santeria and Brujeria. Santeria is the white magic. Brujeria is the black magic. It was
so
powerful.
Like they're using fake Catholic saints. They're using pretend. They're hiding
voodoo
inside Catholic theology.
When the Puerto Ricans,
the Catholic
yeah, church. They do. Yeah, when the Puerto Ricans came into my neighborhood, they brought that with them, you know, and it was they started to have the botecas and the all the Santeria, Brujeria stuff in the neighborhood. I lived it. I was attacked by it. It's real stuff.
And I see it at face value. You could enter one of their homes, and they have these like Catholic saints around their house.
Yeah.
And you would be, you know, if you weren't wise to it, you'd be like, oh, this is the Catholic home.
Right.
Look at
right.
this is a saint. Yeah, and then all the saints are like their demonic pagan gods or something
right.
like that.
They did
behind them.
Yeah, they did that to hide their paganism when they were false converts to Christianity. And so they hid it under the yeah. Catholic saints. But, you know, when you look at them close enough, you can see these, you can see their perversions. They're overdoing it with their altars. You can see the things they do. If they want to really be sneaky, they can try to hide it from you. But most of them, you can catch them, you know. But it shows you yeah. how evil and how diabolical that, especially Brujeria, but even Santeria, who pretends to be the white witches, we're the good ones. We're the ones that want to heal you and do good stuff. And so that movie brings out, it tries to support Santeria a little bit. That's why I put my comments in there. But this is true. This is, you know, people look at that and they laugh at it and go, yeah, well, when it happens to you, you're not going to be laughing too much. You know, if God ever let the devil unleash them on you, you know. So that was another really powerhouse movie, true movie. Go ahead. Which one?
She also watched the one on and the Prophet Daniel. I don't know if you have that.
Oh,
one.
Yeah. We just ordered it. She told me about it. Yeah, we're going to order that. Yeah. I'm going to order it.
Yeah. Cause that was good. I like that.
It looked good.
No censor required.
Yeah, yeah. It looks like very much. It looked good to me. So we're ordering that. But and anything that needs to be sent, you know, like when you censor these movies, it's like looking at a whole different movie and you can watch them comfortably. You don't got to worry about bad scenes or immoral scenes or even heresies. And so it turns out to be really good. Even the good Bible movies, they always have one or two bad scenes that need to be taken out. So there's a lot of good stuff to be learned from the enemy too and his ways.
I thought that a really good movie that was another example of that was A Man for All Seasons. And the people who were making the movie thought that they were showing how much of a hero Thomas More was. But when you watch it,
yes,
it actually exposes yeah. how slimy he was.
Absolutely,
you're watching it carefully.
Absolutely, when you watch it with faith, that's a good point. Because you know what's amazing about that movie? That's why I put it in there. We all loved it, you know, in the beginning. Oh, what a man of God! This look good. He's talking about heretics, you know. And oh, we all thought this was like the best Catholic movie in the world, right? But then when you become Catholic and you finally you have the faith for the first time in your life. But I'll tell you, I'm gonna go back up a little on this. Even though I thought it was a really great Catholic movie, there were some points in there that made me uncomfortable. When he wouldn't profess the faith, when he remained silent, I didn't like that. The other scene, too, when he said to his daughter, some men are called to be saints and we're not, so we can sort of like, you know, compromise. I never liked that. But she, you know what's bad about that? It gives you the idea that you can do that and be a saint. I'll tell you, there's another movie I brought in. Sometimes you think you can't redeem it, and one of them was The Merchant of Venice. But I'm glad I redeemed it because I chopped out half the movie, at least, about the courtship stuff and all that. But the part about the Jew, that part is excellent. So I'm glad I kept it, but I had to chop out like maybe half of the movie. But the part that's left in there is really good about the greediness, and not just the greediness of the Jew, but the usury and the borrowing of the nominal Catholics. So there was a lot of good in that, but I had to cut out at least half of it. All right, now I guess we should be signing off soon, but like I said, I'm going to be posting these things up. So by the time of Christmas Eve and maybe even for Advent, I'll have it all up there, all the points on, but I'm not going to have it up on my site yet. And then you could read all the points. And those are all the ones I think where people might have trouble with it. And then unless you, for some other reason you want to wait, you can wait. But I think there's no reason why we can't bring all the catechumens in on Christmas Eve. And Ryan could visit us here. We could do it on video, and we can have all you in Ireland. Maybe you can all go up to Dermot's, or they can go down to whatever's easier for you to all gather together. And all right, so may the Lord God grant us all the graces to be perfect and holy. Saint Patrick, the Moses of Ireland, pray for us. Goodbye, Ireland. Goodbye, Ryan. And goodbye, Philip McCabe. This recording was produced by Mary's Little Remnant, 302 East Joffrey Street, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, 87901. -2878 and can be accessed on my website at www.johnthebaptist.us.